Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Debunking Economics Podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Today, recessions. The world's been in one or is in the midst of one, and even if it is not officially in one right now, it's a bit meaningless not to call it a recession because of the size of the economy is so much smaller than it was. And we know for sure that Europe is in the midst of a double dip recession. So we've had recessions before, but not like this massive economic downturn that we've got right now. So what's so different, apart from COVID-19, of course? And what have been the most common causes of recessions in the past? That's today on the Debunking Economics Podcast. Welcome along. Well, we know the 2008 financial crisis was brought about by the financial sector. God bless them. The subprime mortgages from the mortgage lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac basically packaging up those dodgy loans as mortgage-backed securities in ways that hid the true risk involved in lending. But we're in a very different place now. And yet, GDP has fallen more than any time since the Second World War, but we're expecting a rapid recovery. And whilst government spending is at unprecedented levels, nobody seems too worried about it. So does that mean, Steve, that we haven't got too much to worry about? I mean, this is a very different recession to previous recessions, isn't it? Because if we look back at what causes recessions, which ones are the worst, do you think? Which ones leave the economy the most deeply scarred?
Well, it's always the ones involving credit, when you have a credit boom followed by a credit crunch. And that was the classic story with 1929. It was the classic story with 2007, because in both cases you had huge levels of private debt compared to surrounding periods. But you then had the growth in debt, which is credit, the annual change in debt. I define, and accountants define that as credit. I've got a dispute with some of my economist friends, and you can use the words interchangeably. Debt is what you owe. Credit is how much more you owe over a particular period of time. And if you look at the 2007, the rate of change of private debt hit in America, which I'll use as my benchmark all the time, hit 15% of GDP. Now, that's the highest it's ever been in the history of American capitalism.
Right.
So
What happened then is that because as it keeps on rising, banks have got to try and find new ways to perpetuate that, which is why we got the whole repackaging up of dodgy loans, because you had to go after the dodgy loans because everybody else had already borrowed.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that was all happening sort of between 2000 and 2005. And the level of household that actually peaked in 2006, and the fact that it turned down despite all the encouragements that were out there, was a bit of a sign of what was to come. But the basic story is you go from a high level of positive credit to a high level of negative credit, and that's what gives you a financial crisis. So in 2007, you went from credit being 15% of GDP on the positive side to -5% on the negative. And then you look back at the
growth is slowing. So in effect,
it plunges. It goes positive to negative. Yeah.
And you've said this so many times, haven't you? That it's that speed of growth. It's that credit, rather than debt in total, which is creating the problem. Because in effect, it's all new money being ploughed into the economy, and then all of a sudden, that new money stops.
And in fact, it goes in reverse. But this time, to get that situation, you normally have a credit bust. You've normally got to have a credit boom beforehand. And we had that in spades in 2007. We had it in spades back in 1929. But this time round, there was no real credit boom going on. There was positive credit, so debt was rising, but not much faster than GDP. And consequently, there was not this huge... We haven't climbed a huge cliff. So when you jump off this particular cliff we're on, you're not going to be you're in the ground and you're jumping into the hole rather than being on a cliff above the ground and you jump into the same hole. So we can have negative credit this time round. I say could, we won't necessarily will have it, but we could have it. But it won't be preceded by massively positive credit. So the shift the downturn won't be as severe because you haven't climbed as high before it started.
I mean, sometimes people say it's really been the banks that are to blame for all of this. It was bad management practices by the banks that, you know, governments had eased up on restrictions for banks too much so they could lend too much. You know, the loan-to-value ratios that the banks are prepared to offer were eased off. I mean, is there any argument in that, or is it just the appetite for credit which had driven us to those boom times that obviously have the consequences you talked about?
Oh, it's definitely the banks. I mean, the banks definitely deserve the blame for this because they just got caught in a lending frenzy. And I mean, one of our his supporters and regular listeners, Richard Vague, has plenty of information on that, having been in banking and deciding to get out in 2005, because he could see what was coming, and it was this huge increase in bank debt, and they were basically, you know, you lend to anybody with a pulse when a euphoric period is going on, and that was certainly the case between it goes right back to 1996 96 to 2006 with a bit of a blip in 2000 2001. It was just a nonstop credit orgy, and that's what got Richard to get out. He saw the amount of money being borrowed.
So the warning signs are going to be the amount of people in the marketing departments of banks. Presumably, the more people they're taking on in marketing, the more they're trying to issue loans to people, the worse it's going
to
get.
To some extent, I mean, yeah, I mean, if you can certainly get plenty of indicators. I mean, there are things like the Americans keep tabs on the willingness to lend of loan officers in banks, and that's always a reasonable expose of what's going to come your way next. But with the 2000-2007 period, you had the state getting in there as well. So you had another good colleagues in the finance sector, Doug Holland, was a complete critic of Fannie Mae, which is typical American. You're making up a nice personable name for a government institution, the federal mortgage assurance organization, whatever it was called, and they were just buying all the loans that were being created by these, you know, first tier lenders with third tier products, and that just kept the whole bubble going. So you had everything, you know, throwing credit on the fire to cause the boom in 2007, which was up till 2007, which of course bust in 2007 and went from massively positive to massively negative. So that's very much a bank-driven process.
There was another thing that happened in those years as well. Manufacturing numbers started to fall, and we've seen that ahead of quite a few recessions. There's no reason why, if you've got more, particularly household debt, that would be reflected in manufacturing. And yet it's almost as though the manufacturing sector knew the recession was on the way. How come, do you reckon?
Oh, actually, that's intriguing. Have you got any data on that you can quote over the radio? Okay. Give me that first.
I mean, I'm looking at the PMIs, actually. They're the numbers.
Okay,
the
Purchasing
Managers Index, which shows that in 2008, I mean, it was 2008 is hard to tell because it was at 50 and it was going down to 45. Anything below 50, of course, means that purchasing managers are seeing
contraction.
It's subtraction. So it looks like it was going down in subtraction just before then. But if we look at the last few years before COVID, so from 2018 onwards, I guess we were looking. There was a lot of recession talk around, wasn't it? So it went from 55. It was below 50. It was already in retraction territory before we hit the pandemic. I can't go back any further on the data that I've got to hand, but I'm hearing, you know, I've been reading, you know, just an observation that before recessions, very often we see as a precursor, we sort of see a slide in manufacturing. I'm just wondering if you've got a theory as to why that might be.
Well, I just say, well, normally because there are lags involved in this sort of stuff. So, like when you look at the level of household debt, for example, which was obviously driving the mortgage market, that didn't peak in 2007. It peaked in 2006. So what you had was the household sector was already turning down before it hit the aggregate economy, and that's partially because households had, despite the attractions of all the, you know, subprime loans that were out there and so on, they were actually slowing down the rate of borrowing, or you had people going bankrupt who couldn't hang on long enough to end up flipping the house into a rising market. So the fall in house prices and the fall in household new household credit occurred before the downturn overall. And it might be the business sector has sort of, you know, is projecting forward the rate of growth you're seeing in the household sector to begin with. So they're borrowing like crazy to finance what they're doing, both in terms of speculation and investment. But they're blindsided by the fact the household sector slows more rapidly than they expect. So you've got the business sector's borrowing to keep on financing expanding output, while the household sector has stopped its level of borrowing and is now cutting back on expenditure. And you therefore get this
falling demand,
decline in manufacturing sales before the actual crisis begins.
It makes a great deal of sense. So does it always, if you look back at all of these recessions, and we will start talking about the one that we're, you know, that we're in with COVID, but I mean, before now, are they almost always related to, if you look at the very heart of it, is loans for housing front and center of it all?
It's one of the major ones, and without a doubt. I mean, again, quoting Rich's work on this, even the Great Depression or the boom of the 1920s that led to the bubble that then led to the crash of the 1930s, that was driven by a housing bubble. And that's disappeared from the data, but Richard got his own research team in debt economics to go backwards and actually look even at newspaper records. And they found, yes, there was a big housing bubble, I think went from about 1920 to 23, and that set off the whole financial excess that ended up with the stock market bubble bursting in 1929. So it is commonly the case that a household bubble is as part of the overall process. But even having said that, the business debt is much more volatile and much more cyclical. And you can see businesses reacting to what's happening to one of their major customer groups, which is the household sector, and occasionally going too far. When there's a boom in the household sector, then the business sector jumps on shortly afterwards. So if you go back to, let's see, I'll give a few little dates here going way, way back. If you go right back to the end of the Second World War, corporate debt was 23% of GDP, and household debt was 10% of GDP. So trivial levels. Fast forward to the financial crisis in 2008, and household debt peaked at 98% of GDP, and business debt kept on rising. And this is why I'm making the point about the time lags between the two. Business debt kept on rising even though household debt was falling. So you had a period from the level of household debt peaked in February of 2008 at 98% of GDP, on almost 99%, but business debt kept on rising. It was down at about 70%, and it kept on going to 72% when you'd already had the housing sector. It was well and truly in reverse.
Right.
And they both went into reverse.
Yeah.
And that's what made the crisis so steep.
Yeah, so they just, so they invested in growth that didn't eventuate. So they've so they're left with excess capacity, but they've still got to pay the loan on it.
That's right. So and that would have come up. That would turn up in your PMI numbers as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, that makes a great deal of sense. The difference this time around, of course, and I'm hearing that there's actually not, you know, a lot of businesses haven't actually acquired that much debt. I mean, there's been grants, there's been furloughing schemes, and early on, large businesses took on quite a lot of debt, but then not since. And in fact, you know, a lot of the large businesses actually have paid that debt back. So the accumulated debt is not so great. And I guess that, you know, for the same reason that businesses
are. No,
You think that's not the case?
Well, I'm going to actually looking at data. You know me, I was always
numbers. You're going to hit me with facts now. Good Lord! Oh,
sorry about that, mate. Yeah, look, I'll change professions.
Become a journalist.
Okay, let's just actually do this now. I'm just going to take a look at the. Just because you might be looking at your UK data.
Well, I'm basing it on hearsay, where I've heard so many people saying now actually the amount of debt that large businesses in particular have acquired isn't that great during this pandemic, and then that's got to be a good sign that they will be able to pick up and recover, because they're not going to be they're not going to be held back in it.
That might be true of the UK to some extent. It's not true of America. So if I look at the UK, if you go back to the beginning of 2020, the level of corporate debt was 71% of GDP, and it is now 79% of GDP.
Oh, okay, so it has leapt up.
That's a huge increase in that's over 9
GDP's
months.
Fallen a bit though.
If you go to America, the change in corporate debt is from before the crisis began 76% of GDP, 83%
Okay. Right. And that's just to get
a big increase in corporate
debt. So I'm going to turn my point around completely then, because that's a bad sign, isn't it? Because that is just muddling through. That is not building for growth, because no one would be borrowing right now to build up until they had an idea of the time scale. So growth could be very slow out of this because of that, couldn't it?
That's what worries me. I mean, you would probably know this. You might even use it as part of the podcast. You know the old Australian song, A Pub With No Beer?
Yeah. Yes. Was it Slim Dusty? Yeah.
It's never something so mournful and drear as to stand at the bar in a pub with no beer. Well, this to me is going to be the slump with no boom.
Yeah.
Because normally you get a boom before a credit crunch. This may well end up being a credit crunch, credit going negative after this period of positive borrowing just for the sake of covering a cash flow. That's what, obviously corporations aren't borrowing to expand and invest right now. They're borrowing because the cash coming in is less than their financial commitments. So they're running up overdrafts, they're running up lines of credit to stay solvent while getting more in debt at the same time. So that's my worry that not guaranteed.
The forecasts are, from old Gus bodies like the IMF, for example, that we're going to see a big increase. I mean, the problem we've got, of course, is that it's a double whammy, isn't it, this time around? Because, GDP, we've had a big hit on GDP, obviously more than any time since the Second World War. And it's part of that is because because demand has fallen because people can't get out and supply has fallen because people can't go to work. It's very rare you get a double hit like that. It's normally one or the other.
Yeah, that's right. And this is a totally unique experience, at least in the history of capitalism thus far. I mean, to me, of course, it's a precursor of what we're going to see massively out of climate change. And that's, in the long run, nothing is exogenous. Mm. So we are finding ourselves causing things like the coronavirus to come back and bite us. But in terms of the historical record, this is the first time it's happened. So normally, like what a lot of economists will do if they get something like the Great Depression, they'll leave that out as an outlier. Oh, dear, that's more than 5 standard deviations outside my data set. Therefore, it must be an outlier. I will ignore that data and fit my model to the other bits and pieces of the data. Well, thanks a lot, mate.
This is a big one and a bit too recent for people in our lifetime to ignore those, isn't it, I think. The other thing that happens, of course, is that, which we're not seeing this time, is that inverted yield curve, the spread between 2 and 10-year treasury bonds in previous recessions. In fact, it's been used, hasn't it, as a good indicator of recessions if it goes negative. So the yield on long-term bonds falls below those on short-term bonds. So that's a reflection of how investors see the long-term. And if they don't think it's so good, then the yield curve goes negative. Mm. We're a long way from that now. We've been throughout the pandemic, it's actually been the other way around. So I guess there's another recession indicator that we can throw in the bin.
Yeah, and I'm still not saying there will necessarily be a recession on the other side, because there's so much government spending going in at the moment. And households may well redirect a lot of their spending so that parts of the economy which have suffered may have a boom on the other side. It's obviously tourism is going to suffer and suffer very badly. But spending, there may be some redirection of spending that keeps other sectors alive while that one suffers in particular.
That's the hope, isn't it? I mean, that's why that is, and just your comment on those GDP numbers, which are, very high, like 5% or so for the UK, for example, for 2021. It's what the IMF is forecasting, similar numbers, in fact, more for the United States and a little less for Europe. A lot of it's based on vaccine rollouts and how quickly they're happening. But there's this expectation, isn't it, that the section of the community, exactly as you're saying, that are going to spend, and okay, it may not be in some sectors, but it'll get spread to other sectors. And lots of people saying, well, we're going to go through the roaring 20s again for exactly the same reasons. We're out of a war. This time we're out of a pandemic. Well, last time we were out of a pandemic as well, of course. And we that deferred spending is going to happen. The government's going to spend. We get big construction projects, particularly in the United States, and a decade of rapid economic growth. So the roaring 20s could. I mean, we know what happens next, of course. Is that possible?
Because what happens next has already happened back in 2007. We've had a private debt bubble and crash, and because we haven't got rid of the overhang of private debt, we're not likely to see the level of credit-driven demand that we saw back in the Great Depression. I mean, the thing which is quite fascinating to me, and this is something I've been looking at because I know how much margin debt, for example, drives share prices. We know how big the share market bubble is in America right now at the valuation for the American stock market using Robert Shiller's cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio. It's now at the fourth highest level it's ever been, the stock market valuation, fourth highest in the history of the index. The third highest was actually back in 2018. So we're getting back to the stage where the market is as overvalued as it was back then. The only period that beats that 2018 for stock market valuation is 2000. Even 2007 has a lower level of overvaluation than we have at the moment. So the cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio that one of Robert Shiller's creations was 29 in 2007. It is now 36.
But I mean, that's looking.
If
that's looking,
average is 14.
But if that's looking at it, right? Okay, but if that's looking at earnings right now during a pandemic, so it would be, I mean, it would be safer to have a look at what the earnings were just before the pandemic and what the expectation is that they will come back to.
That's the beauty of this particular index. It's using earnings for the previous 10 years.
All right. Okay. Cool.
So the beauty of that index is that it leaves out those ludicrous periods of massive overvaluations for some indices and undervaluations for others. So even with these huge periods of boom and bust, if you look at the data, ever since 1983, the stock market has been on its tear compared to its historical average. But the historical average is 20.5. As I said, at the moment, we're running at 36.
Yeah. So, I mean, could we see then that there is a stock market crash like we saw in the
yeah, well, I mean,
we've had the housing price crash. Everyone's gone, okay, we won't put as much money into property. Let's put it in the stock market. That's a bit safer. Mm. And then the same thing happens there.
Well, the trouble is here we have an actor we've never had before on the scale that it's involved now in the stock market, and that's the Federal Reserve and central banks around the world with quantitative easing. That's a roundabout way of driving share prices higher. Yeah. And every time, when it was first instituted back in 2010 or thereabouts, I called it a pact with the devil. Once you've signed up, you can't decide to revise the contract. Tough luck. So every time they've tried to get out of QE, they've got back into QE again when the stock market starts to fall. And I really wonder about the people in the Federal Reserve. Are they looking at long-term indicators like the cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio, the CAPE index? Are they looking at this and seeing what they've done to the valuation level? Because as I've said, the long-term average is 20 and the current level is 36. When you go back to the 2000 bubble, which is the highest level of valuation history, that was 48. Now, why do they think it has to keep on rising? And it really, in QE, we look at the impact of QE, the market fell down to as low as 15, which was the pre-bubble average to some extent. So it's gone from 15 to 36, more than doubled during the period of QE.
Why do they do it without any concern for the underlying value? It's because everybody wins. They keep on saying this, don't they? They say it with a straight face that if the stock market goes higher, then your pension fund goes higher. Proportionally the rich get much, much, much richer for a while, but that doesn't seem to matter too much, does it? That's the depth of their argument, isn't it? If it goes up, then everyone gets richer.
Fundamentally, it's what I call critical trickle-down economics.
Yeah.
And it's done a pretty good job of tricking down for quite some time, but it's also tricking up, because if you take a look at the level of margin debt, we are now back to a level of margin debt which has not been seen since 1930 as a percentage of GDP. So margin debt is now 3.4% of GDP. The previous peak was back in 2018 at 3.4%. Before that, we got the peak level of 3% in 2000. So we've got more margin debt now than we had back in 2000. And the only one I want to leave it standing is the level during the Great Depression, which was adjusting so that today's data is, history's data is consistent with today's valuations, 13% of GDP. So we're not as speculative as the madness of the 1920s, but there's a huge amount of speculation in there. And therefore, you've now got this, this even more strongly amplifies the power of the Federal Reserve's buying program, which is keeping those ratios up and dragging people in. There's now, if the market starts to fall, there'll be immense pressure on the Federal Reserve to revive the market. So what we have is the Federal Reserve and central banks around the world in general that are dedicated to causing asset price inflation.
So how would they revive the market? I mean, what can they do other than say, well, okay,
QE? If you do more QE, I mean, I've learned a lot about modeling by money, by modeling by building Minsky, as you know. And when you put this together in double entry bookkeeping terms and say what is going on with QE, it's the Federal Reserve. When they were doing it at the tune of $1 trillion worth a year or $80 billion a month, which is roughly $1 trillion US a year, they were saying they're going to be on the buy side in bond sales with the banks at the tune of $1 trillion a year. Now, if that's happening, then what that means is the reserves of the banks are going up, the bond holdings are going down. Reserves don't earn income, bonds do. So that is encouraging the banks to use that money, the whole financial system to use that money, to buy other assets. And this is exactly what Bernanke said it was supposed to cause them to do, to cause a wealth effect. And, of course, when they buy shares, the shareholder, the brokers they buy the shares through, the people they sell buy the shares off, put their money back in a bank again, so the level of reserves don't fall. But you're getting effectively $1 trillion a year of additional buying pressure on the stock market.
Right. And the way to solve that is to buy more of it.
And that's just driving the valuations higher and higher. So this is why I call it a pact with the devil. They've signed up for something I can't stop doing.
So the stock market crash in the Great Depression, you know, it ended the Roaring Twenties. In we saw shares fall. Well, the Dow went from 350 to 200 in a month. So and it, take away the peaks and troughs around that time, it basically went from 300 to 200. So it lost a third. And that obviously resulted in massive job losses, and we saw the Great Depression. I'm just wondering, if you look now, the stock market since the MSCI World Index, so globally, it's even more pronounced in the United States, of course, but globally, shares since January 2020 have gone up 23%. So we're well on our way sort of like to a third. You could almost go, well, okay, well, if we lost a third right now, it would almost be taking us back to, you know, just a little bit below where we were before the pandemic started. No great shakes. Would we actually see the massive job losses that we saw during the Great Depression? I know I'm sort of oversimplifying it, but if you look at a graph, you'll go, oh, it's going to take us back to where we were. That's not so bad, is it?
Yeah. I mean, the reason that it's not as quite as drastic as back in 1929 is the level of margin debt is both lower now than it was then. It's one quarter now what it was at the peak in the Great Depression. That's partly the fact that when you're just looking at the scale, the margin debt, the impact of getting a margin call in terms of the impact on GDP, was four times higher in 1929 than it is now. However, the other thing is that back in the 1920s, the level of margin debt was 10%. So if you put down $100,000, you could take you could get a brokerage loan of $900,000 and buy $1 million worth of shares. And therefore, a 10% fall in the market would wipe you out completely because as part of the margin call, you're required to maintain the valuation of the portfolio. So if it falls by 10% from it at 1 million to 900,000, then your equity is wiped out. But now the level of margin debt after the Great Depression, one of the few reforms we've stuck with is that margin debt is now limited to 50%. So to buy that $1 million worth, you've got to buy, you've got to put in $500,000. And therefore, the impact of a decline, you have to have much larger decline to wipe out the equity entirely. So it doesn't have quite the same negative impact that it had back in the 1920s. But you will still have people getting margin calls and being sent bankrupt by, you know, a 10 or 20% fall on the stock market, which would be quite feasible given the extent to which it's been pumped up by QE during the pandemic.
So how we go for the next, and look, we're going to talk more about how we get out of the pandemic next time, but just touching on it, if we've got businesses with steeped in debt but wanting to grow, then they would have to go deeper into debt. but also, you know, you're hoping that their spending is up because more people are, you know, out to enjoy life. And you've got to assume that there'll be a little bit of enthusiasm for embracing getting out and spending money. So that's going to help pay off some of that debt at the same time. So it's going to be a growth path, isn't it? It just might not be as fast as people like the IMF are expecting, for example.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I'm expecting. I think there could be a credit crunch coming out of this because a lot of corporations are now carrying more debt. They've got to service out of effectively the same cash flow if we get back to pre-COVID levels of economic activity. So that's a potential worry. And corporations, their first interest, given the extent to which corporate debt has risen during the pandemic, may be to repair their balance sheets first rather than go out to investment, and that itself could cause a negative from the business sector. The arguments about the household sector having done a huge amount of saving and therefore having more money to spend in the future is all based on national accounting, where you have, here's the level of output, we know Y, the symbol that economists use for it, GDP, the gross domestic product. That hasn't fallen as much as consumption has. So the gap between the two is called savings, and it's just an accounting identity at the national accounts level. But that definition of consumption doesn't include servicing your debts. So the money you need to pay your interest bill on the bank loan, the money you might use to pay your debt level down, does not turn up as part of the consumption figures. And therefore, what you see as saving can actually be people getting deeper and deeper into debt because they can't afford to pay the interest bill and they can't afford to pay the debt level down. So I don't believe there's a level of savings that people think the households like they go out there and spend. But it is not likely that the mood will be, let's get out there and party, which was certainly a large part of the mentality back after the Spanish flu.
But we might be, let's get out and party on the cheap, because it's unlikely wages will have increased significantly. I mean, inflation's going nowhere, is it? So, and I suspect, you know, companies that have furloughed workers, many of them were saying, well, you were getting 80% of your salary. That was enough, wasn't it? Let's carry on with that. Or companies saying, can you work 4 days a week rather than 5 days a week? And there's going to be this, you know, because companies have got so much debt, they are going to be trying to keep their wages billed down as much as possible. So that's going to impact consumption.
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, it's if you wanted to choose an uncertain time in human history, this is a pretty good choice, because at least when, like, back in 2008, I could say there's going to be a crisis. The odds, you know, zero odds of avoiding one. Australia managed to make it less than zero by restarting its housing bubble, but ditto Canada. But most countries around the world were, you know, on a hiding to nothing to have a financial crisis this time round. I think there will be a credit crunch potentially, but you've also got authorities that are much more attuned to the dangers of this now than they were back in 2008. So I don't expect a huge hit. I think what's more likely to be a worry is what's going to come out of the climate and out of I think we're counting our pandemic chickens before the vaccines have hatched, I think. So we might be, you know, exaggerating the odds of getting out of this.
Yeah. So one person nobody's going to be reading too much of is Milton Friedman, isn't it? I mean, all this government spending. I mean, if you'd look back in the 1970s, we had this level of spending. Everyone would be going, we are setting ourselves up for a fall by having the government spending so much. And that would chip away at confidence, and that would almost certainly cause a recession. But that is not the route we're going to take this time, is it? It's been accepted.
Well, it wasn't the route we took back then anyway. But it's some people are arguing that. I'm reading a guy's book right now because I'm involved in a debate with over a debt jubilee tomorrow. I'm actually going to put a note about that on Patreon in case people want to listen in. But there are plenty of people saying, oh, there's been so much government spending. What you watch is going to be huge inflation. Mm. Of course, most of the government spending has been making up for a collapse in private spending. And then a huge part of the credit creation people are seeing, or the money they're looking at, is actually the central banks buying bonds off the private sector again, which does not create money. So I think there's an exaggerated fear of inflation caused by that. What would worry me more likely, and I think this is going to happen over the next decade, is inflation in food prices at some point, because we're going to start seeing climate hits in the next, I think the next decade. I'm fairly, you know, I'm not a climate scientist, obviously, but what I'm looking at, I think, oh, it's going to happen this decade or next. If it happens this decade and we start seeing food shortages coming out of it, then we're going to have massive inflation on the food end of the consumption spectrum, but a collapse in other prices where people, you know, less money to spend on television sets, you end up buying food instead. So your overall CPI might still be going down, but part of it will be going up.
And in fact, on that, Bloomberg's been reporting this week rising crop prices in the United States because there's big demand for food from China because of concerns of the drought, and also the cost of picking crops is increasing as well. So and we're already starting to see that. We're already starting to see a bit of inflation being driven through from food prices.
Yeah, so it's an uncertain time in human history. And the only certainty I can see is climate change is going to come and bite us big time. The question is how that's manifests, and the timing is when it starts. But, you know, in that sense, 2020, rather than being this terrible year we can all look back on and say, thank God, we've now got 2020 in hindsight, that may have just been the hors d'oeuvres for the next decade.
We can say that's when it all began. Yeah. Well, look, we're going to talk more about how we get out of this next week. So sort of following on from today's discussion, I guess. But it seems to be what you're saying is that you don't know what the next year is going to bring. Almost certainly, we're not going to see the sorts of growth that are being bandied about because, as you're saying, the amount we might be surprised about the amount of money that's really not sitting in people's bank accounts ready to be spent. And also, we've got the concerns from business about leveraging even further than they are currently. The government could do a bit about that, though, couldn't they? Just as they've tried to stimulate the household spending, they could do the same by trying to stimulate business spending, couldn't they? I mean, for example, more grants rather than loans.
Yeah, I mean, the government, this is what we're learning from the debate of a modern monetary theory, that the government is not constrained by having to borrow money from anybody else. It creates money when it runs a deficit. So if that starts to sink in, then, and like the deficit itself turns up as a large part of the profits of corporations. That's what's called the Kolesky profit equation. So it's quite feasible that the government could try to do that to keep corporations afloat, as well they might need to in the next decade or two as climate change starts to bite.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, we'll look at this more next week. We'll see if there is a route out of it, what you'd suggest. I think we might have just touched on it. But we'll be back again next week. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, mate.
And that's it for this week. I'm Phil Dobby, back with Steve again next week for another one. See you then.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.